Thanks for listening to Fly Racing Racer X podcast with Kurt Nickel. And before I get too far into this thing, I want to thank the folks at Racetech. They partnered up with FMF for the Privateer Power Award at every national this summer. You know FMF's involved with privateers. Well, dude, FMF and Racetech go together like peanut butter and jelly. Racetech.com, supporting privateers out there in the summer. Tell them you listen to Pulp to get a discount. Show the company some support for helping these privateers out by getting your motor work done, getting some suspension work done. Racetech.com. Tell them you listen to Pulp. On to the show.
A Pulp MX Network production.
Welcome to the Fly Racing Steve Mathis Show, presented by Maxxis Tires, Renthal, and Motorsport.com on RacerXOnline.com. With your continuing gracious support of our sponsors, we're thriving at over 1,800 podcasts delivered with over 20 million downloads. Click the Amazon banner on Pulp MX to help us out. Donate via Patreon if it suits you. And as always, enrich your moto lifestyle by working with the sponsors who support us. The original Moto Podcast, featuring legends of the past, stars of today, season previews, race reviews, introspection, opinion, facts, and laughs. Here's the voice bringing it all to you, Steve Mathis.
Say that dedication to your frustration.
Welcome, everybody, to the Fly Racing Racer X podcast. Kurt Nickel, sort of my old boss, really, KTM when I started there, 2000, 2001. And, he was the head of KTM Racing. So we're going to talk about that. But we're mostly going to talk about his new role, senior consultant for the World Supercross guys. And, dive into that, what it entails, what he's doing, how it came about. And we'll bench race with him as well about Champion MX and all of that, what he's got going on. So thank you for listening. Fly Racing 2025. This is the end of July as I record this. You can get it August 1st, 2025. Gear is out. Thank you to the folks at Fly Racing for all that they do. Evo gear, F16, they redesigned it as well. They added some stretch panels to the Evo and to the Kinetic as well. So new colors, new designs, lots of things going on at Fly Racing, flyracing.com. Love the Formula helmet, of course. And please check them out, man, at your local dealer at motorsport.com. RJ Hampshire, Chance Hymus, JB, Dean Wilson, Fly Racing, flyracing.com. For more information on that. And thank you to those guys. We'll tell you more about Renthal later. Speaking of Kurt and UK, it's Renthal. But I also want to talk about Maxxis Tires, Maxxis.com. Light truck tires, trailer tires, you know about that. Support that. But they got great mountain bike tires, and they got dirt bike tires as well. Fast Freddy Noren using Maxxis to go top 10 at Washougal. And, man, they got tires designed by some guy named Jeremy McGrath that raced Kurt Nickel back in the day. He does a great job. They got soft intermediate to hard terrain tires at Maxxis now, and they support a lot of privateer teams. So I know you probably haven't thought about Maxxis for a tire, motocross-wise, but start thinking about it. Did I say stop? Start thinking about it. And Maxxis.com for more information on that. Motorsport.com as well. We just got done with Washougal. The motorsport guys are huge at Washougal. They're huge in the motorcycle industry. And, OEM and aftermarket parts, great shipping, great pricing. They got a dedicated team of gearheads there to help you out, and they have e-bike stuff as well. So it's the best online place to buy motocross parts and accessories, without a doubt. And they deliver on everything they say they're going to do, and they do a great job. Motorsport.com, and appreciate those guys. Go through the banner on pulpmx.com to help us out. Fly Racing, Renthal, Maxxis, Motorsport, helping us out on this podcast, man. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Kurt. King Kurt Nickel on various projects that he's into and various things he's doing. Always fun to catch up with Kurt. Don't forget Champion MX. Don't forget World Supercross. And away we go. All right, everybody. As promised on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast, a gentleman that I've known for a long time, got a lot of respect for, and has won a shit ton of races over the years. And some news for him. Senior consultant for the World Supercross Series. It's King Kurt Nickel. What's up, Kurt? How are you, man?
Hey, Steve. I'm good, man. Just got back a couple of days ago from jolly old England, and back in some warm weather without any rain in Southern California.
Yeah, that's something California's hard to beat, right? It really is hard to beat that weather.
I think you forget or I forget, what England's like can be like in July. It was pretty amazing. It rained pretty much every day.
Did it really? Jeez.
But we were pretty lucky on the weekend. So
nice. Yeah, you came back from Farley Castle. I want to talk about that because I went to Fox Hill last year, and I'm going this year. And yeah, I want to talk to you about that later on for sure. There's a lot going on with you. Senior consultant for the World Supercross Series, four-round series they announced, kicking off in my home country of Canada in the fall, and lots of changes for this series from year one to year two to now year three. Take us through it a little bit. What appealed to you about this? How did you get the gig? What's your thoughts on being a senior consultant?
Yeah, so, I mean, I was actually really excited about the series when it was first announced because, you know, obviously – I raced MXGP for a lot of years. And then when I was running the race teams for KTM, we did MXGP and US Supercross. And to be honest, all the way through, I was one of the few that was keen on expanding Supercross to the rest of the world, knowing that there is, you know, there's a huge appetite for Supercross everywhere. You know, it just never seemed to be out of work. And it was tried. You know, we had a few races early in the 2000s. I remember Amsterdam and Geneva and some races in Canada. But it sort of every time faded away and seemed to end up back in the US. So when they announced it 3 years ago, I was excited and thought, you know, this could be the serious move towards actually having Supercross in places all around the world. Obviously I wasn't involved at that point, and they definitely had a tough start. You know, they seemed to have a pretty good first year, and then they announced a bunch of races for the second year, and some of the races didn't happen, and it seemed to meander and lose its way, and so they had a restructure, got some new management, and one of the guys that was drafted in to help them, an Australian guy, used to work with me at Nitro Circus, and so he's a really smart guy, smart businessman, not necessarily a supercross motocross guy. So he called me and basically asked if I had any interest in helping him to kind of steady the ship and get World Supercross back on track. And, you know, it definitely, just as it appealed to me 3 years ago, it appeals to me now, because, you know, I still firmly believe that Supercross should be a global sport.
Yeah, I agree too. There was lots of consternation over here when the series got started under the old owners, and some things I got, but to me, bringing Supercross to the rest of the world, having riders and teams make money and providing, some top level racing, I don't see the problem in that. Do I ever think it will come to the same level as the American Supercross series? Probably not, but there's certainly a market for it. I mean, you look at all the races that, I mean, you probably did over the years back in the day, and yeah, fans want to see these guys. They want to see these names, Ken Roczen and everybody else, right? Like, I think it can work, and I like going in the fall. I think that's a positive step for that. And four rounds, I guess, Kurt, with that, let's get restarted and get a footprint again, huh?
Yeah. So, I mean, I as much as I say that I am excited and was excited about World Supercross, I actually wasn't excited about some of the things that were done in the beginning at all. Firmly believe, and as you know, consulting for the series now, that World Supercross has to fit in with the existing series, which means the calendar has to fit around US Supercross, the calendar has to fit around US Motocross, the calendar has to fit around MXGP. The way it was started was very confrontational, but is absolutely not the way that I plan to do it. You know, I mean,
well, that's good.
My ideas for the series is definitely not to take over Supercross or take over Supercross Motocross. My idea for the series is to bring Supercross to places that don't have Supercross right now, and to have a bona fide world championship that riders from from the US, from NXGP, from Europe, from all over the world can take part in. You know, I think one of the things which has happened in motocross and supercross over the last few years, probably the last 20 years, to be honest, is the two disciplines have come much closer together. Mm-hmm. You know, back in my day, you know, as a motocross rider, I never did supercross. Supercross was a different technique. Mm-hmm. It was way beyond anything that I could do because I wasn't brought up with it. Nowadays, all the riders that are racing motocross can race supercross as well, and that shows when, you know, now in the US, when we have people like Vial, and then Prado comes over and does a few races and does really well. And,
yeah,
you know, the disciplines are much closer together, and so my vision for this is that it, you know, it's not just the top US current supercross riders that could race supercross. You know, this is all the motocross riders from all over the world, including MXGP, that are, you know, that can race supercross as well if we do a good job.
And for as far as your senior consultant, will you be on the ground at these races to work with riders and teams and try to tweak things, listen to them, you know, make things better? Is that the role I envision, or is it something else?
No, that is definitely it. Yep. I mean, right now what I'm doing, you know, is twofold. I'm certainly liaising with the teams and the riders to, you know, get the best lineup that we can, mm-hmm. and to try to get the series so that it appeals to riders and teams. And then, you know, also look for a vision beyond that into the next few years, in the direction to take the series as well. And I'll definitely be on the ground at the, in Vancouver, Perth and Abu Dhabi this year.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, again, like, you know, no matter what they're doing, I think the teams and the riders want to see a face they know, and that would be you, and a guy that's been there and done that at the highest levels and racing. So it's great to have someone like you involved, I would think, with the series, and gives them some credibility, right?
So yeah, and there's a lot of credibility that needs to be built up, because, you know, when you have a series that kind of splutters, and then you announce a very confrontational schedule, mm-hmm. Falls across everybody else, and then you have to pull races back because they're not working. I mean, all of these things kill credibility. So a big part of my job right now is to regain that credibility, mm-hmm. and, you know, to have a four-round series this year that, you know, that World Supercross can be proud of, that the riders and the teams consider to be a success, and then build from there.
You got Vancouver, October 26th, doubleheader in Perth, November 23rd, 24th, and then December 4th, Abu Dhabi, which was on the schedule last year as well. I saw that Tom Burwell was named as a CEO for WSX. Do you know this gentleman? He comes from a car racing background, it looks like. What's your interaction so far, or thoughts on this?
Yeah, I didn't know Tom until he joined the team, but I've met him a few times since, talked to him a lot, very smart gentleman, and I think a great addition. You know, he's worked in Formula One and, you know, has a very clear focus on how, you know, how Supercross could be grown into the future, and certainly seems to follow the ethos that we all have now, which is, like I say, to mm-hmm. grow World Supercross to be a complementary part of what already exists in our sport.
How's it been dealing with the existing teams? You know, there's been talk of some renegotiating some of the terms for the teams, and I understand that. It was, you know, talking to the old guys that were involved, it didn't really work out the way they wanted to with the reimbursements, and I understand some teams are dropping out. So take us through what you can with the teams and talking to them and making sure they're, you know, on board and all everything else. I can't imagine that's been easy because, you know, some of these teams are like, hey, man, you know, we already have an agreement, and you guys are like, yeah, but old owners, let's talk about it to make this so we all win here. So that's probably been a bit of a bouncing act for you, Kurt?
It has. A lot of this has been challenging in the last couple of months, is exactly what I just said about regaining credibility. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of that's been regaining credibility with the existing teams and riders. But I feel like the teams that are going to take part this year, they're very supportive. Mm-hmm. I think they all followed the vision, 2-3 years ago. And, as it lost its way in the last year, they probably lost some confidence or did lose some confidence. And so we're regaining their trust and regaining their confidence. And, mm-hmm. and I feel like it's already, they're very supportive. They mm-hmm. they follow the same vision. And, that's the thing that I think is important here, is that, we've got teams and riders and now a management structure that actually wants to grow this World Supercross into something that, it can actually fit into motocross and supercross and mm-hmm. that everyone can take part of in the next few years.
Yeah, I felt for Adam and some of the other guys that some of these teams that signed up did not put the effort in that they sort of promised with quality of riders and quality of racing. And at times I think that frustrated Adam and the old guys. And, it sucked because everyone kind of wasn't living to the spirit of the racing. And so I think for you, that's number one. It's like, hey, we don't need, the absolute best guys. We got Roczen, of course, but we need good racers, and that's to me a part of your pitch, I guess, to these people, right?
Yeah, I'm certainly not going to point any fingers at what happened in the past. Mm-hmm. We're moving forward, and the feeling that I have with the teams is that they do want to race and they do want to have a good series, and most of them. They're racers, they want to win, and so they want to put up a team that can do the best that they can, and everybody's looking forward, and I think the time for looking back's probably gone now.
Yeah.
And now we're certainly not starting with a blank sheet, because that was 3 years ago. We're starting with something below a blank sheet, but I think that we've got a lot of people involved now that to support the series and want to make it successful, and that to me is the most important thing.
Can you give us any hints on teams? I think MCR's in. Pipes is obviously coming back. Do you want to drop that, or do you want to wait? Do we have to wait?
No, I can't right now. Right. We're still working on the lineups,
sure.
but it's going to be we've got some exciting announcements to come.
Okay.
The big thing first of all, when I started here, was to get out a calendar and to get out a schedule that could actually be achieved.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think that the schedule is going to look like this in the coming years? No, I don't. I think there's a lot of places in the rest of the world that Supercross can be super successful. But at the moment, we have to do the three cities, the four rounds, mm-hmm. and these are places where that can be achieved. So,
and from what I understand, 250s are back, right? Like there was talk of that not happening, but they're back from what I gather.
No, they're back.
Yep.
250 and 450. Exactly, as it was envisioned last year. There's going to be some changes in the format of mm-hmm. the races, which will be announced shortly as well. But basically, the teams will be as they were, where each team fields 250 riders and 450 riders.
Let me ask you this in a general sense, not asking you to give anything away, Kurt, here on the show. By the way, Fly Racing, RacerX podcast, flyracing.com, 2025 line is out now. I liked some of the formats that they did. I liked some of the ideas they had, no heat races and things like that, and the different lengths. And some of the things worked, some of them didn't. And without giving anything away, Kurt, just you fundamentally, Kurt Nickel, having raced all over the world and been a part of, the highest programs you can get, what do you believe in, or what do you like to see in a racing format as a fan, as a guy that runs the race teams, and as a guy as a senior consultant? Like, is there a few things that you're just like, this is what we're missing in Supercross, and we want to bring it to World Supercross? Anything just personally on your own?
I think that like you, there's certainly parts of that format of World Supercross that already happened that I liked, and those parts will definitely be brought back. I think overall the Triple Crown type format is not the only thing that it lacks for me is, you know, you don't have that big focus that you have with a main event in Supercross. So I think the challenge here is to kind of get the best riders on the track as much as possible, have them racing as hard as they can, not make, you know, I like the short races. You know, I know that it's, as a racer, you know, if you get a good start, you love a short race. If you get a bad start, you like a long race. But, you know, short races, you know, we've also got to attract fans to Supercross that are not necessarily hardcore fans. You know, this initially, yes, you know, we've got to make this series so that the fans of Supercross and motocross all over the world are excited about it and want to come and see it. But a secondary point is that, you know, you need to expand the fan base as well. And, you know, a 20-minute main event that meanders to the end of it, you know, can sometimes be, in my opinion, a little bit long for someone that doesn't fully understand it. You know, I mean, someone like me or you, Steve, I mean, we would be, even if the race has sort of petered out a bit at the end, you know, you're still watching the guy in eighth place with some excitement, but that's not the same for a casual fan. So, you know, I think just addressing those points, trying to make it so that it's credible as a race format for racers, so you get the right winners, but try to make it exciting enough so that you can attract hardcore fans and also perhaps a more casual fan as well.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the Triple Crowns, but that definitely in that last one when everybody kind of knows where they're at, there's not a lot. Sometimes there's not a lot of racing, you know, over here in America, and you're just like sitting there. So I get that. Do you anticipate World Supercross having a TV deal where we can see it over here, either streaming or over the air, something?
I don't know.
Okay.
Honestly speaking, I haven't got my face into TV deals. Okay. There's more than enough for me to do with teams, riders, formats than TV. So I'm sure that there'll be TV packages announced. And you know, I managed to watch the races last year somehow. Yeah. I can't remember how, but I'm sure that they'll be available one way or another.
Did you already call Mr. Peer or Pitt or anybody? Has that call already been made, Kurt?
You know, it hasn't. I'll be completely honest with you. You know, if I obviously know those guys very, very well.
Yeah.
But what I want to do and what I was clear with everybody at World Supercross is that first we have to get the credibility of the series and do what we said we were going to do. Mm-hmm. And when we do that through 2024, you know, it's one thing talking about it. It's another thing doing it. Once we've shown that we can do it, you know, then I certainly will be interested to talk to Stefan Peer and to Pit Byra. But I haven't done that at the moment,
I like it. Yeah, I think you're realizing some of the mistakes that were made. And like you said, like, you're a guy, too, that you're kind of a no-bullshit guy, from what I know of you, right? So you're also one of those guys like, hey, let's do what we say what we're going to do, and then go from there, right?
That's exactly it. I mean, talk is cheap, and, you know, we actually got to show what we can do. And then because, you know, I mean, it's not I ran those teams at KTM, and somebody coming in and saying, hey, I want you to just support this brand new series and put a bunch of money into it and do that. I mean, it doesn't work like that. And I think the people that started World Supercross, the management team, I think they thought that was the way that the world worked. It isn't the way the world works. You know, you have to give a reason for the OEMs to actually want to get involved, not just tell them that you're going to take over the world, because, you know, they have no reason to believe that. And they would have been proven in not believing it. So.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great thing. World Supercross coming this fall. You ever been to Vancouver? Beautiful city.
I have. I went to Vancouver when the World AMA Supercross was there. A couple of years, I think. Yeah, I really enjoyed those races, Vancouver and Toronto. Again, like I say, there's Canada is one of those countries where, you know, Canadian people want to see Supercross.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt. And so, you know, I'm glad that we can go up to Vancouver and bring Supercross back to Canada.
Yeah, for sure. That'd be great. I'm going to try to make that one. So hopefully I can get a media pass for that, Kurt. We'll talk then. Did I forget anything else about World Supercross? You want to get the message out, or can we talk about Champion MX a little bit?
Let's talk about Champion MX.
Yeah, so this is something you started a few years back. I've seen you out at the races at the tracks in California, and, you know, you're basically people from all over the world come over, and you take them around, and they rent bikes. You do a little bit of coaching if you need to. You get your own laps in because you absolutely shred on a bike still. How's it going? How's championmx.com? I'm guessing the World Supercross guys are perfectly fine with you continuing this, and I'm sure it's not something that you would give up pretty easy. How's it going?
No, it's going great.
Yep.
And I mean, it's over the last few years, you know, things changed a little bit with it. You know, when we went through COVID, obviously no one could travel. And so I think the last time we spoke on this show was before COVID.
Yep.
Since COVID happened, a lot of the guys that were doing the same thing as me disappeared just because they couldn't. I'm very lucky in the fact that I have great support from KTM, and, you know, they supply me with the bikes every year, brand new bikes. And so we managed to get ourselves through COVID, and now everything is, you know, basically flat out again. I mean, the last winter was our busiest ever winter.
Was it really?
Yeah. And we were busy all the way through from World Vet in October, basically all the way through until the National at Parla. And so now it's summertime, it's a lot quieter. But we already have a ton of bookings. The next really busy time for us is going to be when playoffs are in Vegas.
Oh yeah. Yep.
And then that's pretty much straight after that, then we start to rev up for World Vet, which is actually the biggest event of the year for us. What I'm going to do this year again is I'll keep my 2024 bikes and get my 2025s before World Vet. So I will have, I think, 26 riders coming over for World Vet.
Wow, jeez. And are they all from the UK, or are they from all over? Like, you're obviously
from all over.
Yeah, from all over, because you're a huge guy in the UK, right? Everybody grew up watching you race, but it's from all over. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the UK is probably still the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, it is still the biggest, but I mean, for World Vet, I have people from Brazil, Hawaii, Australia, Germany, literally everywhere. People come over, and actually, if I had 40 bikes, I could probably do 40 bikes for World Vet, but there's a limit. It's such a huge event, and it just seems to grow and grow. Are you going to come out and race this year? Or?
I am. I had a bit of an elbow issue last year, but it looks like I'll be back in this year. Plus, Kurt, I just turned 50, so I can now jump up and maybe do a little better.
Right.
So, you know. So the Vegas SMX thing. So people can come in, they rent a bike, you'll take them to the tracks, California, and you'll take them to a race in Vegas too. I didn't know that was part of the deal. I thought it was more like a bike rental coaching thing, but yeah.
It is, basically.
Yep.
People, you know, mostly they'll take themselves to Vegas.
Yeah, okay. All right.
But they still, you know, when they come in, you know, they like to come in and do some riding around those events. That's basically the way it works. And so, you know, we're very busy the sort of 10 days to 2 weeks before and the 10 days to 2 weeks after. There's just people bringing their vacation around that event.
Do you take them to Pro Circuit and Troy Lee and his places too, or tell them how to go and all that, arrange that kind of stuff?
I don't normally take them, but we certainly give everybody the right ideas. Mm-hmm. Take them to KTM. We try to make it a full motocross immersed vacation. Yeah.
Speaking about the World Vets too, I like the fact that they cut one moto, three motos over 2 days. It's not so rushed. They're better organized. They have more time for track work. The guys, I've been critical of the Glen Helen guys for some of that race because it is really cool. It's people from all over the world, but sometimes I'm just like, hey guys, if you just settle down a little bit, you can make this event better. And I think they have. They've tried. They got some corrals now, Kurt. It's not such a chaos anymore. So,
I like the three motor format as well. Yeah. I think that it makes it just so that before, when they did the Saturday and then the Sunday was for championships, it was a little bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
The guys that come in, I think most of them are happy to race the 2 days and to kind of spread it out over the 2 days, rather than do one warm-up day and then one championship day. So, I think the three-motor format worked really well.
I always have to laugh because when we're there, it's just you and Dubok, dude. You got to be so tired of that fucking guy.
He's
tired of you. And he's tired of you.
We were talking about it the other day. And what's weird is that, as we get older, and he's already 60 and I'm nearly 60, we're still the same speed round Glen Helen, the same as we were when we were freaking 40.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so annoying.
Right.
And we're obviously both slower than we were, but we seem to be slowing up at the same rate.
But nobody's gotten any better or worse. I just have to laugh. I'm like, there's Kurt chasing Doug. There's no one who's got more laps of Glen Helen than Doug Dubok. Just, it's impossible.
No. And I can't stand him beating me, and he can't stand me beating him. It's crazy. We're 60 years old, and we still want to beat each other.
I love it. I think it's awesome. And then, not that long ago, Johnny O and Wardy were at a mountain bike race, maybe a couple years ago, and I was like, look at these two guys. Just chasing each other still, it just never goes away, right?
It doesn't.
ChampionMX.com, everybody, for more about that. You just got, speaking of racing, you just got back from Farley. I went last year to Fox Hill, Dave and Wobbs's event, and I guess they're going to run Farley too this year again, and Fox Hill, and then Daub ran the Farley one, I think you went to. Insane. The UK, two strokes, dual shock, single shock, whatever. These fans are absolute bonkers for this stuff, Kurt.
Yeah, it's absolutely mental. It's difficult to
it is,
understand.
Right?
I think that people think that I'm sort of making it up, but the MXGP at Matley Basin is half the size of that race at Fox Hills. It's just as simple as that. This year it's ticket only at Fox Hills. They haven't even got space to sell tickets on the day, and I don't know what their cap is, but there's going to be 25,000 fans there, and it's just difficult to understand, but it's just it. I don't know if it's
what is it, why are the Brits so mad about this stuff?
I don't know. Back in the day, of course, a British MXGP in the 80s was always 30,000-40,000 fans there, and I guess those fans have just grown older and older, but it's not even that, because my son, my nephew, they all they don't actually go to the MXGP, but they all go to Fox Hills. I don't know. It's just Dave King and Wobbs, they've done a really, really good job of marketing that event. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge scene. Even the race at Farley that I just did, there was 60 entries and they were full by 9:05, and then the reserve list is after that. And so there's just a huge appetite for older riders and older riders on older bikes.
I went last year. That Wobbs has been bugging me for years, but I always had a national on that weekend to cover, and I finally went last year, and I was just blown away. And I'm going back this year. I'm going to miss Ironman again. And yeah, it's just nuts. I was just in awe. And this year, I'm gonna get to race. And so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, that's awesome. What bike are you gonna ride?
Not too bad. 04 YZ250. So pretty good. Pretty good bike.
Right.
Wobbs.
Yeah. I mean, they've changed the rules over the years and made it more and more sort of modern.
So yeah.
Now we're at the point where you can basically ride anything that's still a two-stroke.
What'd you ride at Farley?
Until that time.
Oh, yeah. What'd you ride at
Farley? KX500.
A KX500. Okay, so I thought that KX500. One was more a dual shock, a twin shock one. Is there one that's more towards dual shocks, twin?
No, actually, this Farley one that James Dobb runs, that's more modern bikes.
Yep.
It's older riders on modern bikes. And then the Fox Hill one is the sort of two strokes up until the early 2000s. And then the other Farley that Dave King and Wobbs are going to run, that's kind of more on the twin shock side.
Okay. Right.
But the twin shocks feels like it's fading away a little bit. I think that's difficult for the guys to keep them going. I mean, you know, now you're looking at bikes from the 70s and they're 50 years old nearly, and so, or not nearly, they are 50 years old, and so they're trying to keep them going. It's getting difficult. So I think the sort of Evo, as they call it, Evo and Super Evo classes is really where the big entries are at now.
Are you, do you like riding the old bikes? The ones you used to race back in the day, do you enjoy that? Or are you like, hey, give me a KTM 450?
It just depends on the track.
Okay.
And so when you get to somewhere like Farley, I absolutely enjoy riding the old bikes, and I think I can ride the old bikes just as fast.
Mm-hmm.
Fox Hills, you know, I think is a little bit more of a modern track. And if, you know, if I go to Fox Raceway in the morning, then, you know, I don't want to take a KX500 around Fox Raceway.
Right,
then give me a KTM 450 2025, please.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, so that's where you're at on that. It's going to be great. Bradshaw's going over, and he was asking me about it this past weekend at Washougal, and I'm like, he's not racing. He's just going to do the parade lap or whatever. He's like, I don't, they tell me it's real big. I'm looking forward to it. I'm like, dude, wait till you wait, Dame, until you roll up in your zebra fox pants. Like, you know, like these guys are going to lose their minds. So,
yeah, well, that's it. For someone like Damon to come for the first time, I mean, he's going to be such a star there that he's not going to felt that type of thing, you know, for a lot of years as a motocross guy. So, he'll enjoy it.
Are you going to Fox Hill then? Are you in?
I am.
Okay.
Yep.
So, yeah. Well, we will see you on the Pulp Show with the beer tent Friday and Saturday night. So
I'll be there.
I got to meet and talk to Thorpe last year. Super good guy. And like, yeah, he was just, they were chanting his name, Kurt. I'm sure they'll chant your name too. I was just like, look at this. It's like I'm back in 89 with these people. So it's really cool. I'm looking forward to it. And the buzz for the UK is great. By the way, Kurt Nicole here on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast. Speaking of old bikes, Renthal still making 971 bend bars for the 7/8 bend, for the 7/8 bikes, for the older bikes. And they have cloth bar pads as well. Renthal.com, of course, and twin wall bar and fat bar and all of that. Please check out Renthal if you can. And they got mountain bike parts now available through Power Sports dealers. So flat pedals and bars and stems and all that, Renthal.com. Thank you to those guys for coming on board. Appreciate it. Few more things, Kurt, before I let you go here. And again, check out Champion MX if you can, and have a hell of a time doing that. You've done a lot in the sport, and you know, when I first met you, you were director of KTM Racing, I believe. I think you were like worldwide, right? Or not just American? You were everything?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
yep.
That's an awesome title, and you know, you transitioned into that sort of not long after you hung up the boots. And then when you left, you went to Nitro Circus, I believe. I'm surprised, like, if you look back on it, I don't know if it was just the stresses or the travel or whatever, but what a job being, especially around that time, being head of KTM Racing worldwide. Great success in GPs, and American stuff was turning around, right, with Langston and all of that. Why'd you leave?
I just grew out of love with doing that job. I did it straight after I finished racing, and I really enjoyed it, and I think I was very effective. I had great empathy with the riders. A lot of the riders were guys that I'd raced with You know, when James Dobb was world champion with KTM and Joel Smets and Shane King and all those guys. Yeah, I mean, this was guys that I'd raced with that I knew very well. And, you know, I was just completely into it and I really enjoyed doing it. And just over time, I don't know, doing the same thing. And, you know, when you're on the road, you know, 40 weekends of the year, and it just got to the point where I guess the riders were getting younger, I was getting older, and the travel was too extensive for me, and I just sort of fell out of love with doing it. It's simple as that. And I just wanted a new challenge. And you know, KTM as well, I mean, it grew so much at that period that, you know, when I first started that job, you know, it was very small. I mean, we didn't really have a race team, to be honest. I mean, when we started the race team here in America, I mean, we had to buy a semi and, you know, we didn't even have a track or anything. And back in those days when you were a mechanic.
We rode at Stefan Alvin's, right? It was like our supercross track.
Exactly. And so, I mean, we had to build all of that infrastructure and everything. And it was a great time. But then when it got bigger and bigger, I don't know, I think, honestly, I probably work better within smaller organizations rather than big corporations. And so it just got to that time where I wanted a new challenge, and Nitro Circus was exactly at that point where that KTM was out there, where it was very small, and they obviously had huge potential for growth. And so when I jumped in with them, there was like three of us and Travis. And then, you know, that grew and grew and grew over the next few years as well. And so, I don't know, I think for me, there's always a bit of a time limit. I like to try new things and try new challenges, and, you know, and World Supercross fits that for me a little bit right now, where, you know, it's something which has got off to a difficult start. But it's something that I believe in, and that, you know, I'd like to be a part of that growing into something successful as well. And, so, you know, I just got to the end of the point where I was enjoying it. And so move on.
To me, and I don't know you that well, but like, you're still really fit. You're still riding a ton. You're racing. You're a competitive guy, right? And of course, don't even get into your racing career, of course, where you won all those races. So I imagine, I don't know, maybe not, but was the Nitro job a bit like, I'm not battling for wins. I'm not in the competitive nature. Did that take time to get used to? Or maybe you were fine. Yeah, I don't know. But
I don't think it took time to get used to. I raced all the way through, you know, I mean, even after I'd finished racing professional motocross and was working at KTM, I mean, I raced 5 years of the AMA Supermoto Championship. You know, basically full time. I never stopped. And then even when I was at Nitro Circus, I was racing Enduro Cross and won national championships at that as well. And so,
that's where you got it from.
I mean, I love racing, and no matter what I do, you know, that's a big part of it for me. And, you know, honestly, you know, going back to your KTM question, they're also, as the head of racing at KTM, there comes a point where it's so big that, you know, things, you would have to sacrifice certain things. And one of the things that I'm not prepared to sacrifice is being able to go riding and being able to race and do those things. And, you know, at a certain point, it needs maybe somebody that's, you know, prepared to make bigger sacrifices than I am.
That makes sense. You know, and like, and I kind of forgot about your supermoto and all that. So you were still getting that competitiveness out, right? You're still doing that.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever gonna drop away.
No, I don't think so. Was there? I always got the sense. Now, I worked at KTM 2 years, 2000, 2001. And then, you know, we had first year Alan Brown, team manager, Sel Verage was more involved. Second year, Ron Heben came in late and did a pretty good job late. And around, I want to say, maybe it was just 01 because GL was fighting for the title. But was there, I remember you being around a lot more in 01. And I always got a sense that they were like, because let's face it, it wasn't run that well. A lot of things going on behind the scenes, and especially with me being on other teams, you look back on it, you're like, oh wow. I almost wondered, did they put an SOS out for you to like come to America? Was there a little bit of that?
It's a long time ago, yeah. But we at KTM, when we started everything, I think we sort of started it at the time when, you know, the American side were keen on racing some Supercross, and that's how we started it. Mm-hmm. But we quickly realized, within a few months, that actually this is something that had to be mm-hmm. controlled from KTM Austria.
Yep.
That it was a really big thing, and within a short time, my focus changed a lot from yep. being MXGP was the important motocross thing, and we raced a little bit of Supercross for the Americans. That mm-hmm. changed in 6 months, and within 6 months, we were really, really focused on winning a US title and yep. building that team up. And so you're right, absolutely right. In the beginning, there wasn't a huge focus, but within a year, there was a huge focus on it.
You outbid Mitch for GL. That's a great story to listen to Mitch talk about it, and he almost won a title and probably should have. We all know we don't want to revisit that. But was there any other what-ifs, Kurt, at your time for American KTM? Like, was there any things that you're like, oh, we should have done that, or we almost got that guy, or anything else that you can think of?
Well, I mean, back in those times, we were just out starting. We had that no links rear suspension that was not the greatest in Supercross. So,
yep.
And Mitch obviously had the premier 125 program then, and so
yeah,
as outbidding is about the right thing, because the riders were way keen on racing for Mitch, mm-hmm. not racing for KTM. And so, we were always in a point of outbidding, but it went both ways, because I also remember having an agreement with Mike Brown to race KTM the year that he beat Langston in the 125 okay. championship. And then Mitch stole Mike Brown off me.
Okay.
So it went
both
more
ways.
Than one way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, he took Langston away at the end as well.
Yeah.
So, it was tough.
Yep.
It was tough then to try and get the right riders, just mm-hmm. because we were a fledgling program, and maybe, we didn't have the best chassis, although I think we had the best motors. But that changed over the years, and especially once the link got on the bike, which was after my time.
Yep.
And man, how things have changed around now. I mean, KTM has the premier program that everyone wants to be on, and they're pretty much shoo-in now to take another national title this year. And KTM is the lead dirt bike manufacturer in the world. And if you go back to 1992, when KTM went bankrupt, and mm-hmm. I was the only factory rider in 1992.
Turquoise seats, KTM, yeah, green seats.
Yeah, yep. KTM made 2,000 motorcycles that year.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
After the bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And so what a turnaround
yeah.
in 25 years. It was pretty incredible.
I'm guessing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like there was so much success going on in GPs with Langston and really everybody, Shane and Smets and everybody else. Were you on the phone saying, hey, Mr. Pierre, we got to put a link on? And then they were like, well, look, we're winning here and we're not doing that. Obviously, like you said, moving the shock to the side really helped. You could put a big carburetor on that 125, you could straight shot of the air box. Like there was a lot of benefits to not having that shock centered. But I'm guessing you saw this issue and problem and were calling them about this link or not, or I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, so I wasn't that worried about it at MXGP wise, because
right.
we were winning and the bike worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until we started Supercross. And I mean, you were around at that time, and especially, around 2002, 2003. I mean,
yep.
we were endlessly working to try to make that no link system work through Supercross, and especially in the Whoops.
Yep.
And we just couldn't make it work. And so right from that point, then I was pushing very hard
sure, yeah.
To be able to test with a link. But it would have been a massive marketing decision back then. And it, as much as there was a growing understanding that we needed a link, you know, there's also the factory was growing. We were selling tons and tons of motorcycles, you know, more than 100,000 bikes at that time. None of them had links on. And so it had to be a very big marketing decision that was taken to actually do that. And it took a long time for him to come around, even though it was known that in Supercross that link was needed. And when the link finally came on, I mean, a lot of things happened at the same time. Dungey came to KTM, and then, you know, as they say, the rest is history.
I remember they had an English guy there from WP come into the California when I was there, and he was showing me the graph on the dyno of a linked shock and the PDS shock, and they're basically the same graph. And he's like, look at, like, you know, it's two pistons. And he's like, it's the same thing. Like, look at it. And I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, go tell those guys. Because I watched them do the whoops, and by the end of the whoop section, they are hanging on for the dear life. So I know what your paper says, but...
Yeah. I know. Yeah, I mean, we were at that point where I was... You know, on the one hand, I was scared to let the riders go through the whoops during the week because they'd get hurt. But if you didn't send them through the whoops during the week, then when they got to the main event, they couldn't get through them at all. And it was like a balancing act where you held your breath every time they went through.
How much did the McGrath failed thing hurt KTM? Because, you know, again, like when I was there, factory team, and then they went away for a few years. MDK did a little kind of a shitty job of it. And then, you know, it took until Dungey, like you said, coming back, and Roger and Ian. I think the downfall started a little bit with Jeremy, and no one was quite ready for that. Them, KTM, all of that. How bad did that hurt?
I think it was a blip rather than a massive thing. I mean, it was, you know, there was a certain negative around it at the time, but we were nowhere near ready for Jeremy at that point. Mm-hmm. And it was just a mistake. But I think in the scheme of things, the big thing, honestly, for Supercross, especially in the main class, 250, 450, mm-hmm. Was to put the link back on. And at that point was at the point where then KTM, you know, could really become a force in Supercross. And that, you know, definitely took longer than it should have done, because by the time we were at 2003, 2004, we knew we needed it. Mm-hmm. Exactly what you say. I mean, everybody had an idea of how to make it work without the link. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, it couldn't work in Supercross without the link. I mean, it was proven in the end.
No, I agree. Yeah, I mean, enduro stuff, great ground clearance, right? Even horsepower in 125, like I mentioned. But in the end, yeah, Supercross, right? So you got this Champion MX thing. Are you just tired of talking about 94 designations? Like it's got to, you just got to be like, yep, okay, pull up a chair. I'll tell the story again. I mean, it was a great feat. It was fantastic, right? For the country and everything else. But at this point, Kurt, you're just like, all right, here we go. Story time.
No. There's a lot of things I may get bored of in my life, but talking about 1994 motocross nations is probably not one of them.
Okay, good. No, I just, you know, how many times can you, but it was an awesome day. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was incredible. And now, I've been doing actually a lot of more talking about it because it's 30 years this year.
Motocross
nations is in the UK.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've actually, there's going to be a remake of the video that the guys from Motorvision that did the original one are working on right now, that they're hoping will be ready for a premiere at Natalie Basin. So that's going to be exciting. And, you know, actually, Farley Castle, Rob Herring raced. I haven't raced with Rob Herring since way back.
Yeah.
And so... still hasn't actually been an event since where myself, Rob, and Paul have been in attendance together.
Oh, really?
And Dave Thorpe. And, you know, I think Natalie Basin this year might be the first time that the three of us and Dave Thorpe would be together at the same venue. I'm not sure if that'll happen yet, but
Wow.
There's It's I've been at events with Paul and I've been at events with Rob, but I've never, the three of us have never got together with Dave.
Oh, wow. So. That's cool. No, that'd be awesome. I hope that happens, you know? Yeah, what a day. Rob Herring was so fast at times. I couldn't believe he never got more wins, right? In his prime, he was some races. I watched some YouTube race of an indoor UK supercross race, and like prime Ricky Johnson in like 87, this is 88, 87 or 88, he held Ricky off for most of the race, you know, and Ricky was the best supercross rider in the world. And Rob Herring gave him all he wanted. He just, God, he was good.
Yeah, no, he was a phenomenal rider. He just didn't, he didn't quite apply himself to get that consistency, but speed for speed on his day, there was nobody quicker at that time. And, during this, the last few months when we've been doing some work towards this video, you know, Rob almost feels like he was the forgotten man of 94 because, you know, Malin obviously was the big deal winning the 125 races. And then, you know, I had the glory of being the one that went over the finish line to win us the event. And but Rob, you know, that first 250 race, I mean, he was phenomenal in that as well. And you know, no one should forget that without, you know, you needed five scores, and you know, Rob finished second in that first 250 race, and he, you know, he more than did his bit. I mean, that the whole thing about that, the Motocross of Nations, is that all three riders have to perform.
Yeah,
and that's what didn't happen. The only country that had three riders performing on a regular basis at that time was the USA. And we were the first country that actually managed to have three riders perform on the same day, and that's why we won. And you know, that was why we broke the 13-year streak, is just because three riders came together and all had good days.
Yeah, you read back the history of it, and like Italy was winning, and Puzar didn't make the Parc de Fermé one year. Then there was the Sweden one where Dirk Gerkens or Geikens crashed late. There were so many times USA kind of snuck it out, you know, and they just got some fortunate luck. And people forget about that, but you guys were the one to take them down. So,
yeah, and when you – I mean, I raced the Motocross of Nations 11 times, and multiple times we had two riders performing on the day. And so did a lot of other countries, but the USA at that time had, you know, just had the depth, and all three riders were. And when we went to the 94 Nations, you know, I would say that my performance in the 500 would have been expected. Rob to do one good race in the 250 would also have been expected, but no one expected Paul Malin to beat Jeff Emmett twice.
And he got a Chesterfield bike, right, for that race? Is that the story? He got a factory bike?
Yes.
Bike? Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, he got a factory bike for the first. He'd never even seen the bike until Saturday morning.
Yeah, like, you wouldn't think that would really work out that well, but clearly.
No. No, and that was the whole thing. I mean, even when I finished the first moto, which I finished third in, you know, obviously back then, you know, you had to wait a while because the 125s weren't as competitive as the 500s. And so I sort of, as I went over the finish line, I had no idea. And I asked my mechanic, you know, how's Paul doing? And I was fully expecting to hear him say, you know, he's doing all right, he's fifth or sixth. And he said, he's winning. I'm like, oh, all right.
Yeah. You're like, all right. You never won a world championship. You came as close as anybody could. And I'm guessing that tops it for you, that 94 Des Nations, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely the highlight of my motocross career, without doubt.
I was talking to Thorpe about this, and by the way, and I told him, I may have been a few beers deep, Kurt, at the tent in Fox Hill, but I told him, I'm like, it's complete bullshit that MXA sort of tarred and feathered you from 86 when you whooped everyone in 85, like in Germany, Thorpe did, right? And it's just like, people forget about that. And so, yeah, he had 86, Johnny O, 125, I get it, but he had some brake problems and all that. Anyways, I was talking to him about back then traveling the U.S. GPs, and he was telling me, like, basically all of you guys in the GP championship, like, you're flying across the country, you're on an American track, you know, it was like, Thorpe was like, go, RJ and Bailey, like Carlsbad or Hollister, Dogger, go, we don't care. I got to beat Kurt, or I got to beat, you know, Jackie Martins or whoever. Like, do you remember that being that sort of attitude of like, just, yeah, we're in our own championship here. I'm not going to try to race you, Lachine, you know?
I don't know. I mean, if I'm honest, I mean, I think that that group of American riders that you're talking about with Lachine and Ward and Amara and Bailey and Johnson, and I mean, the list goes on. Yeah. You know, I think they were ahead. I do. Okay. I think if they'd have come over and raced World Championship at that point and done the full series, then, you know, I think that they would have won. I think that there was a difference in technique that was developed over here via Supercross, and it took a while for Europe to catch up. And I think by the time we got to the early 90s, then the European motocross had caught up. We still weren't doing Supercross, we still don't now, but the motocross had caught up. And, you know, by the Stefan Evert's era, I think that motocross-wise, Stefan Evert's was absolutely the equal of any American motocross rider in the 90s, including Jeremy or, you know, Jeff Emig or all of the top riders in the 90s. I don't say that Stefan was faster in motocross, but it was certainly the equal. I don't believe that we were the equal of those riders I mentioned in the 80s. Okay. I think technique-wise, we were a little bit behind, which, you know, not ashamed to admit that.
Yeah. A couple more for you before we let you go. You're not a guy to make a lot of excuses like you just proved and all this, but if you get on a factory Honda and not Kawasaki, you probably win a world championship. Like, how much did you give up to those Hondas back in your era? Late 80s and all that.
Yeah, I mean, I did give up a little bit.
Yep.
And, you know, I think David Thorpe would also admit that.
Right, yeah, he jumped on.
Whether I'd have won a world championship is still a question, right?
Right.
I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. I do believe that there was, you know, there's certain deficiencies in my ride that I didn't put right, maybe until it was a little bit too late.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest one was, you know, it meant so much to me back then that sometimes I felt like I couldn't get the most out of myself. You know, I was always felt like I was riding at 90% and that the other 10% was being hung back so that nothing bad would happen and that I'd still be around to race the next week. And I felt like I cured that much later on. And so, you know, once I was racing Supermoto and, you know, doing other events, then I, you know, quite often felt like I'd ride 100% then. And I think the great champions, you know, your Ricky Carmichaels and Jeremy McGraths and these guys, I think that they have that ability to be able to ride at 99% most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that I had that through my career. And so, you know, just saying that if I'd have jumped on a factory Honda, I'd have been world champion is too simplistic.
Sure.
They were the best bikes. I think everybody knows that.
Yeah.
But I still would have had to get through a season and pilot it through, and we'll never know.
Yeah.
So
no. I'm guessing when you jumped on what did you get on Honda? 91, 92, somewhere around there?
93, I raced 250 Honda. I mean, the only actual time that I raced a 500 Honda in my whole career was the Motocross de Nations in 94, which was kind of a hybrid between my 250 chassis and one of Dave Thorpe's old factory Honda engines. So that was the only time that I actually rode a 500 Honda.
Yeah, why'd you go to 250s that one year? Just money?
I lost the 500 championship by 1 point in 92, and it was at that point where the 250 was taken over as the premier class in Europe. And so all the best riders were going 250, and I just felt like I needed a new challenge.
Sure.
And so, again, if I'd have stayed 500, would I have been world champion? I mean, probably I'd have been the overwhelming favorite. But it wasn't the important thing to me. It was to be racing with the best riders at the time and having the motivation to do everything that was needed. And I felt like that was 250, and I loved those years that I raced 250s. I won Grand Prix, again, didn't win a world championship, but raced consistently on the podium, and I really enjoyed that time as well. So
you didn't find that you didn't find that the length of time in 500s and letting the thing, rev out and riding it, lugging it, all that didn't hurt you in 250s, or it didn't take you long to get used to a 250 mentality a little bit?
No, I didn't. I think everybody thought it would, but it didn't. I mean, the first race that I did in 1993 when I changed to 250s was that Beaucaire International race that everybody used to do, and I won the first moto. So I think I adapted really quickly, and the 250s got very good. If you remember at that time, I mean, in the 80s, definitely a good 500 was the way to go. By the time we got to the early 90s, the 500s were already a little bit uncontrollable and difficult.
Yep.
And those factory 250s that I had with the Castrol Honda team were excellent motorcycles.
They looked cool. I know that. They looked really neat. Like your gear setup and the bike setup was cool looking back then.
Yeah, no, they were very good. I mean, I could have, I could have raced KTM and gone 250, but that would have been a difficult transition, I think, because the best bike to be on was a good Honda at that time.
So when you go riding now, I've seen you race a 125. I've seen you ride four strokes around at the local tracks when I'm out there. What do you like to ride right now? Like if you just could grab anything, two stroke, four stroke, 350, 450, what do you like?
Oh God! It really is whichever day takes my fancy.
Okay.
I have a bunch of bikes, and if I ride a 450 for 2 days, then I can't wait to jump on a 300 two stroke.
Okay.
And if I ride a 300 two stroke for a couple of days, then I might want to jump back on a 350. I ride everything.
Okay.
And I enjoy that. And then I enjoy going back and racing a KX500 as well. But I think if you told me I got to ride a KX500 every day, I might get a little bit tiresome.
Hey, Kiefer tells me that I got to ride that 350, the new one, a couple years now that they redesigned it. But he is a fan of that 350, man. Like, he loves it.
Yeah, no, I think you'd like it. I think it is. It's a cliche, but I do think it's like an ideal vet bike.
Mm-hmm.
And you just told me you turned 50, which I can barely believe. But, when you turn 50, you should be on a 350, man.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we'll keep that in mind. Hey, and also, before I let you go, I've become friends with Jason Bonham a little bit through some different areas. And I'm a huge fan of his band. He's in with Hagar and all that. I'm going to go see him soon. But he was blowing my mind with stories about his dad's team back in the day and supporting you guys. What do you remember from that? That's awesome. His dad was like, didn't really know anything about it, but his kid was into it. So his dad was like, all right, I'll start a team.
Yeah. I don't remember a ton about it.
Okay.
I know Jason, and we've talked about this. When he's come over to Anaheim and stuff like that, great guy. But I do remember John showing up in a Rolls Royce at the races, and people saying, that's John Bonham. But look, at the time, I was fully into motocross, so if someone said it was John Bonham, I'd be like, who?
Who? Okay. Yeah, it's really neat that this rock star. Millionaire rock star guy, had a team. So
I really remember him showing up in Rolls Royce to the race, and a Rolls Royce doesn't really fit a motocross track, and then getting out of it like full rock star.
Yeah, that's great. Well, cool, Kurt. Thank you, man. I appreciate the time today on the Fly Racing Racer X podcast. Senior consultant for World Supercross. I know you'll do a good job. I know you got a lot of respect of the riders and teams. So it seems like a good role for you, and you'll help the series out immensely. I think you just when somebody says, "Hey, Kurt Nichols involved," you bring that level of credibility. So those guys are lucky to have you. So thanks for the time, man. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve, and I will see you at the track soon.
Sounds good, Kurt. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, man. Bye.
This has been the Fly Racing Steve Mathis Show, presented by Maxxis Tires, Renthal, Motorsport.com, and Kuba Links on RacerXOnline.com. Thanks for listening and supporting our partners.